Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a big vote in the Navajo Nation presidential election.
But first to the latest news on Ebola. Some good news today. The Dallas nurse Nina Pham has been declared Ebola-free. She spoke just moments ago at a news conference with doctors in Bethesda, Maryland, although that has been overshadowed by the news out of New York City that Dr. Craig Spencer tested positive for the virus last night after coming down with a 100.3-degree fever. Dr. Spencer was working with Doctors Without Borders, treating Ebola patients in Guinea, and had just returned to New York a week ago. Shannon Pettypiece of Bloomberg News joins us from New York with more. Shannon, we know there's a news conference that is about to get underway there in New York, but what are you hearing and how are New Yorkers reacting to this news?
Well, you know, of course, I've seen the whole broad spectrum of reaction. Yesterday, I saw a couple of people walking around with the face masks on. We've been out there interviewing people on the subway who are saying, no, don't worry about it. I overheard one woman's cell phone conversation where she told her friend, oh, you don't have to worry about Ebola. Just don't make out with everyone tonight. So I guess there's a whole range of precautions people seem to be taking. But it's mostly business as usual. The subways were just as crowded as always this morning.
Still, are people saying that it was irresponsible for Dr. Spencer, who had come back from treating Ebola patients in West Africa, to get on the subway, to go to a bowling alley in Brooklyn when he didn't know, he hadn't reached the 21-day period yet?
Well, that is a debate that's going on right now. And members of Congress prior to this had been calling for a quarantine of healthcare workers for 21 days when they were returning from West Africa. And now they're increasing those calls. There was a hearing again today, where members of Congress said we need to have a quarantine for healthcare workers coming back. Now, on the opposing argument to that are doctors who say, listen, we know how to stop this virus. We know that we can self-monitor ourselves when we get a fever, when we start showing symptoms, we'll contact health authorities and hospital, in the hospital and turn ourselves over. But until then, imposing a quarantine on everyone who goes over and volunteers overseas is an unnecessary burden, and it's just going to deter people from going over to volunteer. They say that these doctors are already putting their lives at risk, spending time working in these very difficult conditions in West Africa, and then to have them come back and have to be quarantined in their apartment for 3 weeks, it's just too much burden to be placed on them. That's the two sides of this argument.
Well, right. And although now it looks like maybe it wasn't enough of a burden. But as you look at the reaction from officials in New York, we saw them right out there very quickly after this news came out. Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo urging people to remain calm and that you can still take the subway without fear of contracting Ebola. But what are they doing? What are officials doing there, concrete steps to try and deal with this problem?
Well, they said they learned a lot from what happened in Dallas, particularly when it comes to protecting healthcare workers. So earlier this week, there was a big training of healthcare workers. About 5,000 healthcare workers went through a training at the convention center in New York. There are hospitals throughout the city that have been designated as Ebola treatment centers. Bellevue, where this patient's at, is one of them. So they said, that they've put all these precautions and measures in place over the past months, but especially since this situation in Dallas, to make sure they are prepared. Because, of course, New York's a big gateway for people coming in from all over the world, including West Africa. So this was not a surprise. They say this was not something that they were unprepared for and that everything went exactly as planned. As soon as this doctor had a fever, he called Doctors Without Borders. Doctors Without Borders contacted the city. The city sent a special ambulance crew that was in full protective gear, and they took him to the designated hospital where he was put in isolation.
And what's happening with the people that came into close contact with him?
So there's three people they've identified who came in close contact with him when he may have been showing symptoms. And they believe that people cannot people are not contagious unless they're showing symptoms, and in his case, a fever. So his fiance is being under observation at the hospital right now, and then two of his friends are in quarantine. Then there was also a driver of an Uber car service who drove him and his friends home the evening before he developed a fever. But that driver, they said, was not in close contact with him, so does not need to be quarantined.
Now, Shannon, this is something that, you know, New York has never had to deal with, but there's certainly been big events that shake the city like this, and everybody has to figure out how they're going to respond. We think, of course, of 9/11 and then more recently Hurricane Sandy. How would you say that New Yorkers are taking this news?
I think it's kind of been in your typical New Yorker fashion. Some people have sort of found it an inconvenience, or I'm a New Yorker, I'm not worried about anything. We quoted one person from the neighborhood who said, well, you know, I'm not worried, I don't share bodily fluids with my neighbors. I kind of got some eye rolling from a bus driver this morning when I mentioned it to him and asked if he was worried. And there doesn't seem to be too much panic, at least as far as I can tell.
Shannon Pettypiece of Bloomberg News joining us from New York with the latest on this first case in New York City of Ebola. Shannon, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, something momentous happened just after midnight last night in the Navajo Nation, 27,000 square miles that span Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, with 300,000 enrolled members. The Navajo Nation Council voted in a tiebreaker to remove the requirement that presidential candidates be fluent in the Navajo language. Now, this came after weeks of controversy and debate, and late last night, after a three-hour recess for the solar eclipse. Now, you may have heard what's going on here. One of two presidential candidates, Chris Desheeney, had refused to demonstrate whether he was fluent in the Navajo language. And earlier this week, the Navajo Nation Supreme Court upheld a lower court ruling barring him from the ballot. And now, as we said, the Navajo Council has overturned that. Candace Bagoti is the editor of the Navajo Times, the reservation's only newspaper. She joins us from the Navajo Nation capital, Window Rock, Arizona. So, Candace, interesting that there was this 10-10 tie that needed a tiebreaker to break it, because you tell us that there's an equal divide in the nation over this issue of fluency.
Yes, ma'am. You have the younger generations. You have the urban Navajos who a lot of them are going to school off the reservation, and a lot of them are in support of Mr. Desheeney. And then you have those who, the older generations, as well as, you know, the traditional Navajos who are against Mr. Desheeney. And so I think it is safe to say that there is definitely a divide among the people here.
Well, and it would seem to make sense, but the older generation wants to keep the fluency requirement because they want to keep the language alive. Is the language threatened? I mean, how many members of the nation speak it?
Obviously, a lot of the older generations do speak the Navajo language, but there are also a lot of Navajos, older generations, who, you know, don't believe that the Navajo language is going to survive in the next 10, 15, 20 years. So, you know, I can't say for sure how many people do speak the Navajo language, but it is definitely one of the languages that is still thriving, even though a lot of people do not speak Navajo. So it's definitely been an interesting debate.
Yeah. Well, what's been the reaction then to the council overturning this requirement that the president of the Navajo Nation speak that language?
We have passionate people on both sides. So we have those that do speak the Navajo language. You know, they're very upset, very disappointed in our leaders. A lot of things that are coming out now, you know, a lot of our council delegates, some of them don't speak Navajo, and our speaker pro tem, he doesn't speak Navajo, so he was actually the one that broke the tie. And then you have those who, you know, who are very happy that this has been overturned, but the battle's not over.
Well, and do you worry about that? We met you through our web producer, Rachel Rohr, who was on her trip cross-country speaking to young people and stopped at the Navajo Nation. And you told her then that there was growing discontent with the leadership that's in place. There have been charges of corruption.
Yeah.
And you were concerned about the possibility of violence. Are you still?
Well, now I think, you know, I think it sort of calmed down a little bit from those that are in support of Mr. Dischini, but I think that there still is potential for that because we have passionate people, you know. And I think everyone can agree that the Navajo language is important. It's just whether or not that should be a requirement for someone who is going to run for president, because this is an argument that I've heard, that when the president is meeting with state or, you know, federal officials, he or she will not be speaking in the Navajo language, but rather they need to be, you know, articulate and really know how the government works, not just tribal, but state, official, and county.
So now we have what seems like a potential race between former President Joe Shirley, he had previously served two terms, and Chris Dischini, who it seems as if the council has cleared the way for him to run. Could he do something? Could Dischini do something like, say, he's going to learn the language? I mean, once this, could he possibly hold out some sort of a peace symbol by becoming more fluent in the language and please everyone?
Yeah, well, he has actually been learning the Navajo language, and I have seen him personally speak to a crowd of people, and he has come a long, long way. I have observed that he has been learning. He knows more Navajo than a lot of young people, and probably more than, you know, some of our sitting council members.
Well, meanwhile, I've been on your newspaper's Facebook page. A lot of comments there. One woman thanking the council for protecting her vote because Chris Dischini and Joe Shirley both won the primary, so she feels that her vote for him at that time was protected. Somebody else commenting on the eclipse. Now, we know that the council took a break out of respect for the eclipse last night. Mike Jones writes, traditional teachings teach us that the eclipse is a time of renewal and rejuvenation. Hint, hint to our Navajo Nation Council. In other words, perhaps the eclipse is telling you we need to do something new. Just comment for a second on the eclipse. Why did the council break?
Well, it's a time when traditionals, we observe that time. We don't do anything. We stay indoors. We don't eat. We don't drink. We really just sort of keep to ourselves. We don't work, you know, under the light. And it's just all out of respect for the holy people and the universe. Mm. And so it's really just a time to, you know, respect everything around us.
Fascinating. Candace Bigotti, editor of the Navajo Times, joining us from the Navajo Nation capital, Window Rock, Arizona, to talk about their presidential election. Candace, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
European Union leaders reached a deal today on fighting climate change. They agreed to cut greenhouse gas emissions to at least 40% below 1990 levels by the year 2030. There were deep divisions over the agreement, though. Officials from Poland, which relies on coal for energy, say decarbonizing its economy will slow business growth. Meanwhile, in Australia, there is controversy over coal as well. Environmentalists say it's threatening the Great Barrier Reef. The BBC's John Donison reports.
Everyone knows the Great Barrier Reef. It's a marine paradise, famous
around the world.
The
Great Barrier Reef is one of Australia's most precious treasures.
It's right here at the Southern Great Barrier Reef, which stretches from Bundaberg North Burnett in the south.
Tourism Australia promotes it heavily.
Our region offers visitors unique and diverse landscapes to discover.
A massive multicoloured jewel off the country's eastern seaboard. It covers an area bigger than Britain. There are more than 1,500 species of fish. Some of the coral structures date back up to 20 million years. Environmentalists fear in 20 years, the reef could be all but dead.
I'm convinced the Great Barrier Reef is dying. I've been convinced for many years.
David Hannan is one of the world's leading underwater photographers.
I've been back to some of my favourite spots that I filmed originally many years ago to capture the new material on high definition and found wastelands out there.
For divers like David, the reef was once an underwater wonderland, but more than half the coral has been destroyed in the last 30 years. An aggressive starfish, the crown of thorns, which has flourished because of fertilizers seeping into the ocean from farm runoff, has killed much of it. Tropical storms are also to blame, as well as increased carbon in the atmosphere, which has made the water too acidic. But there's also another threat. This is the massive coal terminal at Hay Point in Queensland, overlooking the turquoise waters of the Coral Sea. Are mountains of coal waiting for export. Australia ships out 1 million tons of coal every single day, and a good proportion of that is dug up in Queensland and heads out through the Great Barrier Reef. Offshore, there are huge coal ships, dozens of them, and environmentalists say dredging shipping lanes so bigger boats can pass through is also damaging the reef.
When it comes to mining in marine habitats, it's suicidal when you've got reef systems on the edge anyway to be putting any more pressures in it.
David Hannan again.
It's that simple. You have to decide whether it's mining or reefs.
But coal brings in billions of dollars every year for the Australian economy. Michael Roach is chief executive of the Queensland Resources Council.
While the rest of the world, particularly Asia, demands our coal or our gas, we will supply it. And if we don't, one of the other 100 countries in the world that produce coal will supply the coal.
And the government sees coal very much as part of Australia's economic future. Here's the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, speaking earlier this month.
Let's have no demonisation of coal. Coal is good for prosperity. Coal is an essential part of our economic future, here in Australia and right around the world.
But that does not bode well for the future of the underwater world that is the Great Barrier Reef, a site which the UN's World Heritage Body has already warned could soon be listed as endangered.
The BBC's John Donison reporting.
Well, basketball fans in Northeast Ohio are counting the days until local hero LeBron James returns to Cleveland Hardwood next week. James got his start as an Ohio high school phenom, then infamously left Cleveland for Miami. That history is the subject of a documentary airing tonight on CNN. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WCPN's David C. Barnett has more from Cleveland.
Before entering his high school junior season, a 16-year-old LeBron James ticked off his skill set for a TV reporter.
I can score, but I can pass too, and I can rebound. I can do so many things that can help my team win, and that's what I do.
In this footage, there's a little more hair on his head, and he hasn't yet inked up his torso with tattoos, but there's no mistaking the familiar face of the legend to be. James attended St. Vincent St. Mary, a Catholic high school on the edge of downtown Akron. In this clip, he warms up with his teammates. This talented group, known as the Fab Five, played and sometimes sang together like a family that knew what each other was thinking. For James, the discipline of the basketball court offered a sense of stability for a kid raised in the projects by a single mom. Drew Joyce, the father of one of the players, coached the boys. He says they first got attention in a national youth basketball league known as the Amateur Athletic Union.
We went to the AAU Nationals when they were 11 years old. We started taking them around the country, all over the state of Ohio, and play. We played in Indiana. And, you know, they stayed at my house, you know, many nights. They just had a bond.
But soon, the media spotlight at St. Vincent St. Mary started to focus on the dominating talents of LeBron James.
Uh-oh! It's the truth. James now with four, and the crowd is really into it. He brought them to their feet with this explosive dunk.
Sports journalist Terry Pluto has written two books on James and his journey from inner-city Akron to NBA glory.
None of them were prepared for, by the time he was a senior, just all the hype. You know, when he went on Sports Illustrated, it just changed everything.
James went to the NBA draft right out of high school and was picked up by the Cavaliers in the first round. It was the story of a hometown boy making good. But after seven seasons with the Cavs, a championship ring proved elusive, and as soon as he became a free agent, James left Cleveland for the Miami Heat in 2010. As a Northeast Ohio basketball fan, Coach Drew Joyce says he was disappointed but doesn't begrudge LeBron for his controversial move.
I understood why he felt like he had to go. He had given the Cavaliers 7 years. The team wasn't going to get there, and he saw it.
In Miami, LeBron James and his new team won two NBA titles. During his time with the Heat, James married his girlfriend from Akron, and writer Terry Pluto says ultimately his new domesticated life convinced him to return to Northeast Ohio.
LeBron has sort of gravitated more towards what you would say kind of the middle class lifestyle. He's got a couple boys and made this decision based primarily on family considerations. They did not like living in Southern Florida.
And now to officially dedicate the LeBron James Arena.
Last year, LeBron James underwrote a million-dollar makeover of the St. Vincent St. Mary's gym, from new bleachers and a gleaming hardwood court out front to new locker rooms. Drew Joyce says he knew James would return.
You know, I always believed he was coming back. I didn't know when, but I just believed it because this is home.
And Northeast Ohio fans are hoping he'll bring home a championship as well. LeBron James begins his reincarnation as a Cleveland Cavalier next Thursday when the Cavs open the season at home against the Knicks. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
And the documentary More Than a Game airs tonight on CNN. You're listening to Here and Now.
And a warning here for listeners. We're going to spend a few minutes now talking about copulation, or sex, as we know it. Australian scientists believe they have found its origin in fish that lived in ancient lakes in Scotland 385 million years ago. BBC science correspondent Rebecca Morell joins us from London to talk more about this. And Rebecca, tell us about this fish. It's called Microbrachius dickii.
Yes, it's kind of a really amazing story, actually. I mean, the little fish, the Microbrachius dickii, it's quite small, just a few inches long, pretty weird looking, very primitive and covered in armour. And what's unusual about this story is that these fish were quite commonplace 385 million years ago, and we've got lots and lots of fossils of them. And scientists have been looking at these fossils for years and years and years. But it took an Australian researcher to actually sift through a box of fish fossils, and he noticed that one of them had a kind of strange L-shaped appendage. And a bit of further investigation revealed that this was actually the male fish's genitals, the first known example of male genitalia in the animal kingdom. Further investigation revealed that the females also had sexual organs too, in this case a small bony structure kind of towards their rear. And if you look at the component parts, the only conclusion you can really come to is that these animals were having sex. They were the first animals to do so. Before that, fish were spawning, releasing sperm and eggs into the water, but these ones were doing it.
And interestingly, after these ones, the fish went back to spawning as they evolved.
Yeah, this is really unusual, because normally if a trait appears like this that you have around today, and you know a number of different species including humans copulate, normally once this evolves for the first time it sticks around. But with these fish, as they further evolved, they kind of decided that, you know, copulation isn't for us, we're going to go back to spawning, back to releasing our sperm and eggs into the water. And it took another few tens of millions of years for copulation to make a comeback again. And this time it was in the ancestors of sharks and rays. And the copulation that you see today actually evolved from that kind of second go at sex rather than the first one in the Microbrachius dickii.
How important is this discovery in terms of understanding evolution?
Well, it's really important, because if you think about it, you know, how creatures reproduce, you know, for a number of reasons, that's an important thing to know about. And scientists have been trying to trace back the first known case of copulation. And this is a bit older than they actually imagined. And actually kind of seeing how these fish did it as well is kind of strange, because they didn't use the missionary position, as it were. They basically had to position themselves side by side. And for years as well, the fish have had, scientists have been wondering, because the fish have had little fins, little arms on their side, and they've been wondering what these were actually used for. But they think the fish actually linked these fins together to kind of stay locked together while they were having sex. So kind of having a glimpse at this really unusual method of copulation is giving a lot of insight into sort of how evolution first tried these practices out.
And we'll put a picture of this, I guess, on our website, hereandnow.org, if you think that's going to be okay for all viewers, Rebecca, do you think?
Yes, it's not too rude. Okay. A little bit rude, but not too rude.
Rebecca Morrell, science correspondent for the BBC. And we've got a link to all this research at our website, hereandnow.org. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you very much.
There's news today out of Egypt that a car bomb attack by suspected jihadists has killed at least 25 Egyptian soldiers at a checkpoint in Sinai. It's being called the deadliest attack in the region in months, and we'll continue to monitor developments there. But we want to talk now about terror closer to home. After those two attacks this week in Canada, the man who attacked Parliament in Ottawa was a Muslim convert, as was the man who ran down a Canadian soldier in an attack on Monday. Joining us via Skype is Wesley Warke, one of Canada's leading terrorism experts. He's a visiting professor at the University of Ottawa. And Professor, we called you there a terrorism expert. Did these attacks surprise you?
Absolutely. I mean, there's always been a problem in Canada since 9/11, and in the sense that, you know, we are aware that terrorism could occur in Canada. But we've enjoyed a run of good luck and good intelligence and law enforcement work in that since 9/11, we have foiled every known terrorist plot that's emerged in Canada. And I think that track record probably led to a belief on the part of many people, including myself, that the likelihood of domestic terrorism plots developing and being successful in terms of their execution was growing ever less likely. So certainly the first attack in Quebec, the murder of the military officer run over by a car, and then followed very, very shortly after by the attack in Ottawa. These twin surprises are absolutely surprises, and I don't think anybody could really stand before anyone and say, you know, we expected this to happen.
And what about the fact that both of these suspects in the attacks this week were recent converts to Islam?
Well, it's obviously a worrying trend for the security authorities. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being a recent convert to Islam. The real problem is that with regard to these two individuals, not only were they recent converts, but they came to embrace a very extreme version of Islam and somehow were radicalized to violence, which is the big concern for security authorities. We've been developing programs in Canada to try and engage with the Muslim community on the part of police force, the RCMP, and the intelligence service, CSIS, in order to be able to kind of monitor developments in those communities and gain their trust as well, and hopefully be able to sort of intersect with them as sources of information about developments. The RCMP, we know with regard to the Quebec convert, Couture Rouleau, were, you know, very close to him, had interviewed him and his family, his imam had intervened with him. In both cases, it draws attention to the kind of mysteries of how people who have converted to Islam come to embrace something well beyond that in terms of a turn to jihadist violence. It also raises questions about just how much did the security and intelligence agencies know about these people, and did they use the opportunities that they had to try and prevent these attacks to the extent that they could have in a democratic and legal setting?
And you say that there is no standard profile for somebody like this who could be a lone wolf terrorist, as we look not just in Canada for possible trouble ahead, but also in the United States. There's no profile we can look for?
And people have been searching for this profile, to be honest, since the 9/11 attacks. I don't think anyone would argue that there is a kind of scientific picture that can be used. There are a set of sort of general characteristics, but they're very loose and nonspecific. So, to a certain extent, this is a kind of necessary pursuit, trying to narrow that range of characteristics to a point where it might help in terms of investigations. But I think we also have to be realistic that you're not going to be able to identify suspects simply on the basis of some kind of profile about how individuals get radicalized. It depends on a kind of deeper intelligence and law enforcement work than that.
Do you think it's premature for people, including the Prime Minister of Canada, to connect these attacks to ISIS?
Well, the Prime Minister has made that connection in his first statement to the nation about the attack in Ottawa. There are elements of a connection, clearly, in terms of what we know about how Monsieur Couturier-Leau, who ran down the two military personnel, used social media and drew on clearly identifiable ISIL propaganda and media postings. Whether one can go so far as to say he was absolutely inspired by the ISIL idea, we perhaps don't have enough information, at least in the public domain, to say that. Perhaps the security authorities know more. We do know that, in terms of his connection to ISIL, that he had an intention to travel to Turkey and on from there to Syria, Iraq, apparently to join ISIL. And this is why, in fact, he was put on Canada's no-fly list and prevented from travel. So there are certainly elements of a connection. Whether the ISIL link was his first inspiration or his sole inspiration, we can't say, but there's enough there to indicate that the ISIL inspiration was significant, and it may well have played a part in the background to the Ottawa shooter's development as well.
So what can be done, Wesley Wark, about this? What can authorities do? And I should say, a lot of people look back at what was done after 9/11 and say the authorities went too far. Lawmakers gave them too much ability to spy on ordinary citizens who aren't doing anything wrong.
Yeah, I don't think that's the solution, to kind of extend the legal powers of security and intelligence agencies to a point where they begin to conflict with kind of democratic norms and civil rights expectations. I think, if we put this in context, there has been a faster identification of ISIL, if you like, as a global threat compared to the view of Al-Qaeda, for example, in the 1990s. There's going to have to be continued emphasis on the foreign fighter problem, and I think probably a return to emphasis on the homegrown terrorism threat, which had fallen down the rung of intelligence priorities as the ISIL problem began to dominate.
Wesley Wark, one of Canada's leading terrorism experts and a visiting professor at the University of Ottawa. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we are also following news today out of New York that Craig Spencer, the doctor who treated Ebola patients in Guinea, has contracted the virus himself and is in isolation in New York City. Meanwhile, today, the Dallas nurse who treated the first patient diagnosed with Ebola in the U.S. is out of the hospital and being called Ebola-free. Nina Pham spoke today outside the National Institutes of Health, where she was being treated in a special isolation unit.
I join you in prayer now for the recovery of others, including my colleague and friend Amber Vinson and Dr. Craig Spencer. I hope that people understand that this illness and this whole experience has been very stressful and challenging for me and for my family. Although I no longer have Ebola, I know that it may be a while before I have my strength back.
And following that news conference, the White House announced it had invited Pham to the Oval Office this afternoon for a meeting with President Obama.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway.
In California, motorcycle riders can head out on the highway and ride between vehicles in traffic. It's called lane splitting, and it's very common, especially when the freeways are jammed with traffic, as they often are. The practice is outlawed in every other state, and while some car drivers say it's dangerous, a new study says it is not that dangerous. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, looked at thousands of accident reports and found that motorcycle lane splitting is no more dangerous than riding a motorcycle in a marked lane. Still, some people who drive cars are not convinced. This woman spoke to NBC Channel 7 in San Diego.
You're really just looking to become a roadkill if you're doing it.
Motorcycle riders are praising the study. A guy who calls himself New York Mike owns San Diego Harley-Davidson.
We don't like to do it, but I'd rather do that than sit in traffic and take a chance that, some car, five cars back, hits the car in front of him or her, and then we eventually get hit, tagged, and knocked off and hurt.
The study did find lane splitters are less likely to be rear-ended, but more likely to rear-end others. And it said that lane splitting does become more dangerous if the motorcycle is traveling 10 miles or more faster than the other traffic. The California Highway Patrol will review the new data as it works on its new guidelines for lane splitting.
And we now have a new phrase that some of us didn't know, lane splitting. Well, it's Friday, so let's go on stage. Our look at what's happening on the boards across the country, marching band competitions, tango festivals, and today, Renaissance fairs.
As mayor,
I welcome you to Rebel Grove!
Hooray!
Huzzah!
Hip, hip!
Huzzah!
Hip, hip!
Huzzah!
God save the Queen!
God save the Queen!
Live mermaids, ladies and gentlemen, live mermaids. Don't miss a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to witness a real live mermaid.
Mermaids? Yes, some Renaissance fairs have gone beyond mead, as we'll hear. That's an announcer at the Mermaid Tank at the Tampa Bay Renaissance Festival in Tampa, Florida. Before that, a parade of soldiers guarding their queen at the Irwindale Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale, California. And we started with sound from the Maryland Renaissance Festival in Crownsville, Maryland. The Texas Renaissance Festival in Todd Mission, Texas, is going on right now. They bill themselves as the largest in the country. They're celebrating 40 years with a King Midas masquerade ball, themed villages, and costume contests. Kim Bryant is one of the judges. She's also an actress at the fair. She plays a fairy and other characters. And she joins us from KUHF in Houston. Hi there, Kim.
Hi there.
And so I watched a video. This seems much broader in theme, too, than some of the Renaissance fairs where everybody tries to stay in medieval mode. Describe what happens at the Texas Renaissance Fair.
We have 8 themed weekends, and they cover a broad expanse of the fantasy world. And so we have Fairy Weekend, we have German Oktoberfest, we have Barbarian Weekend, we have Halloween Weekend, we have Celtic Christmas Weekend. So we try to cover a little bit of everything for our audience.
Well, and there seems to be a little bit of everything on stage. Again, I watched this video. There are belly dancers, which, you know,
yes,
we did not remember him being, you know, at the round table with King Arthur. What are the parameters? What do you tell people, if anything, about, okay, here's what defines us?
Well, we really do try to ask people to be imaginative. And when it comes to costumes, to take some risks. And what I hear our phone operators telling people all the time is that this is the one place you can come and sort of live out a dream of who you might have been, what you daydreamed as a child, mm-hmm, whether that was a superhero or a stormtrooper or a knight of the round table or a belly dancer.
What are some of the costumes people do wear?
Oh, my goodness. We had a beautiful – our costume winner this last weekend was a beautiful leather tooled, dyed Loki costume from the Thor mythology. It was absolutely exquisite. We had, in our first weekend of Oktoberfest, we had genuine German Lederhosen. All of our winners actually had come from Germany. They had actually had them shipped in or bought them on trips, so they were authentic. That's one of the things we do look for when we do look at historical costuming, is whether or not it's authentic and true to detail.
Yeah. And this weekend coming up, All Hallows Eve, what will make something special given how many different things somebody could wear on All Hallows Eve?
We look for things that haven't been done before. If we can find something that is unique or a different spin on something that is traditional, that really stands out. We had a girl this last weekend who had a fairy costume, but she had made it completely out of encyclopedia pages. And so, yes, and complete with a small dragon that perched on her shoulder, and it had a little tail that wound its way all the way to the bottom of the hem of her dress. And amongst all the different fairies that I looked at that day, I thought, that's the first time I have ever seen this. And she had crafted it by hand, painted it, every inch of it. Hmm. And she, you know, ended up being one of the winners in our contest. So we do look for a different spin. We look for whether it's handcrafted and has been well made. So your packaged costumes that you just buy off the rack in a plastic bag, probably usually not going to be on our radar.
Don't even think about it. That's Kim Bryant, a costume judge and actress at the Texas Renaissance Fair in Todd Mission, Texas. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we mentioned, of course, there are stage shows, and that's what makes it part of our segment. Again, in the video, I saw guys who looked like, I don't know, medieval mud wrestlers or something,
yes,
running around.
That's the mud show, the Sturdy Beggars. We love them. They are one of the longest-running acts at the Renaissance Festival. They've been there, I want to say, 35, 36 years, and they are an authentic type of Renaissance entertainment and one of our biggest shows and most popular shows.
And kiss! I'm ugly! Ugly!
They speak in the words of the time, and
we do
grab damsels and plant big muddy kisses on them.
Big muddy kisses.
But there's also fire whipping. Let's take a listen. A man in front of a crowd holding a whip on fire to snap something off of his head. Okay. It sounds like a wild time. Also, by the way, we're reading that the festival hosts weddings.
We do. We do have weddings. We have many, many beautiful weddings. Brides will come out sometimes in period wedding attire. One of the most beautiful ones I saw last year, the bride had lined her gown in Scottish tartan, and her groom had the same tartan on as a kilt. It was really lovely. So people that have loved the fair or met at the fair or perhaps spent a significant part of their dating time at the fair very often will want to come back and have their wedding there.
Well, and you might have one this weekend. That's Kim Bryant talking about the Texas Renaissance Festival. It's taking place right now in Todd Mission, Texas. For more, you can go to hereandnow.org. Kim, have a ball.
Thank you. I do.
We want to take a moment to note a pop culture moment. There are iconic sax solos, Phil Woods on Billy Joel's Just the Way You Are, or David Sanborn on Bowie's Young Americans. We want to note Raphael Ravenscroft on Jerry Rafferty's Baker Street. Jeremy, I just got a little thrill hearing just those few notes.
You know, it reminds me of a great scene in Good Will Hunting where they play
music. They do. Raphael Ravenscroft, what a name. He died at 60 in England. Jerry Rafferty made a fortune on this song. Ravenscroft reportedly made $43. But, you know, not many people can say they seized the zeitgeist. He did. Raphael Ravenscroft on Baker Street. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.